We are going to continue our overview of the Bible as this year we journey through God's Word. And I hope that you've had a chance maybe to follow along with the daily Bible readings for the month of March. And you've looked at the books of Deuteronomy, Joshua, Judges, Ruth, and the first 8 chapters of the book of Samuel. As today we're going to delve into the time period which is characterized by the conquest, the period of the judges, and leading into the monarchy, the United Kingdom in the nation of Israel. There's no doubt that there were portions of our reading this last month that were monotonous, repetitive. In fact, material we've already covered in previous readings. In fact, the word Deuteronomy, which is the title of the fifth book of the Pentateuch, literally means a second law. The reality is, though, is that it's not actually a second law from the standpoint of an additional law that was given, but really it's a reinforcement of the law that was previously given to Israel by God through Moses at Sinai. But now we're at the end of 40 years of wandering in the wilderness. That whole generation has passed away. A new generation has come up. And so this new generation needs to be reminded of God's law and his covenant and how that's going to affect them as they go in to take possession of the land. And even as we got into the book of Joshua, there was certainly some tedious reading, right? Joshua chapter 12 through 21, where they're dividing up the land and all these boundaries and stuff. And so I understand that there were parts of this that were tedious, repetitive, boring, okay? It's okay to say that. But there was also a lot of action in what we read over the last month. We're talking about conquest and warfare. We're talking about espionage and intrigue. We're talking about love and betrayal, the rises and falls of people and nations. We're talking about defeats and redemption. We're talking about love and happy ever afters. So it certainly was an action-packed month this last month. As we take the 30,000-foot overview of this section of Scripture, in those 4.5 books that were covered there, we're covering a period of 355 years of biblical history. As we think about an overview of this section, we see here God powerfully lead his people into the promised land, a land that he had promised years ago to Abraham that he would give to his descendants, and how he gives them of the land freely to possess all of it. All they have to do is reach out and take it. Something, unfortunately, that they did not fully do. And that reminds me in their actions somewhat of their forefathers who 40 years ago, when God said, go in and take the land, they said, no, it's too scary. You can't do it. Here they go in, but they don't actually take all of the land, as we'll see. And we see vividly illustrated what it looks like when man does what's right in his own eyes and disregards God's plan and purpose for him. And along the way, we're going to encounter many noble and faithful men and women who put their unwavering trust in God and take their stand firmly with him. Examples that are certainly worthy of following. Speaking of following, we have this thread that goes throughout all Scripture. Beginning in the garden with God's promise that there was going to be enmity between the seed of woman and the seed of the serpent, the seed of the devil. And we see that line being traced throughout Genesis and throughout the days of the patriarchs. And here we're going to see God continuing to unfold his plan of redemption, not just in seeing the negative consequences of sin and the lack of heeding God's instructions, how that's amply reinforced here, but we're also going to see his patience and his grace and his mercy time and time again demonstrated to his people. And not just in their listening to, in his listening to their cries for redemption, their cries for salvation from their oppressors, and him sending a deliverer to deliver them, but also we're going to begin to see again that line of the seed, the lineage of Christ, as we're introduced to two very important women, Rahab and later Ruth, who find themselves in the direct lineage of Israel's future King David, who will ultimately be the ancestor of the King, Jesus Christ. And so, as we dig a little bit deeper into this section of Scripture, I'm going to again try to tell it like a story. We pick up in the plains of Moab, The Israelites have come in, they've defeated the Ammonites and the people of Bashan, and they've taken possession of their land, and they're dwelling in the plains of Moab, opposite Jericho, across the Jordan, right there next to Mount Nebo or Mount Pisgah. And so we pick up in the plains of Moab on January 7th, 1406 BC, where at the base of Mount Pisgah, Moses has gathered the people together to address them one final time before he passes the baton on to Joshua and then goes up onto Mount Pisgah to survey the promised land and there die and be buried by God. And that's essentially the book of Deuteronomy. In three speeches, Moses will address the people, first reviewing their journey from leaving Egypt up to this point in time, and then reviewing the law, especially as it pertains to the conquest and their dwelling in the land, and then finally giving them some instructions that when they get into the land, they are to renew their covenant with God because they are his special people. And then Moses goes up on the mountain. He's not allowed to go into the promised land, but God says, you can see it all from here. And he surveys the land from the heights of Mount Pisgah, looking out across the Jordan River at the promised land. And there on the mountain, Moses dies at the age of 120 in the 11th month of the 40th year. So sometime in January 1406, he's buried there by God in an undisclosed location. And the people mourn for him for 30 days. Which brings us towards the very end of that 40th year since they came out of Egypt, the 40th year of wandering in the wilderness. So sometime early to mid-February, 1406 BC. And over the next 30 to 45 days, preparations are made for the upcoming military campaigns to invade the land and take possession of the land that God had promised to Abraham and his descendants. This begins with a reconnaissance mission of the city of Jericho, where two spies are sent in to check out the land. There they meet Rahab, the harlot. They're sheltered by her in her home, hidden from the guards of the city, and then later let down through her window using a scarlet cord. And she makes a covenant or bargain with these spies that when they come and take the city, that they will spare her and her family because she believes in God and she wants to be on the right side of this battle. So they tell her to hang the cord up in her window, and so she does. And they go back to Joshua, who's now camped with the rest of the Israelites, the Israelite army next to the Jordan River, awaiting to go into the promised land. And then on March 16th, 1406, the armies of Israel crossed the Jordan River in a manner that is very reminiscent of how the Israelites crossed the Red Sea. There, God parted the waters and they crossed on dry land. Here, God stops up the waters of the Jordan River, holding them up in a heap, providing dry land south downstream from there for the whole army to walk across and gain entry into the promised land. And once they're in the land, in enemy territory, while camping at Gilgal, every soldier in the army of Israel is circumcised, something that had not been done since they came out of Egypt. And there, 4 days later, they celebrate the Passover at its prescribed time for the first time in the promised land. And with the land entered and the preliminary matters addressed, Joshua next turns his attention to the actual conquest of the land, which is carried out essentially in three major campaigns. The first campaign is the one we're most familiar with because it has the most details given to us. It's the central campaign. It begins with the conquest of Jericho, where God miraculously gives the armies of Israel the city of Jericho by causing the walls to tumble down flat simply because the army marched around the city. Of course, everything in that first city was supposed to be dedicated to God, but there was a guy by the name of Achan who took some stuff for himself, hid it in his tents. And because of that, when the Israelites went to go attack the next city, Ai, they were defeated. That was because sin was in the camp. So they had to root that sin out. Ultimately, Achan and his whole family are killed because of his sin. And now that sin has been removed, God takes his stand with the Israelites once again, and they go and defeat the people of Ai. And they fight a few other battles around, but then they are visited by a people that appear to be from a faraway country. In reality, they were just from a town 20, 30 miles away, Gibeah. And they say, "We've come from a distant land. We've heard about your God and all the great things that he's doing. Let's make a covenant together." And so Joshua and the elders enter into a covenant with the Gibeonites. Problem with that was that they lived in the land of Canaan. And God had specifically told them, don't make any treaties or covenants with any of the people of the land. You are to utterly destroy all of the inhabitants. But they failed to consult God on this occasion. And because of their failure, they made an ill-advised covenant with the people they were supposed to destroy. And this is actually what leads into the southern campaign. In the central campaign, they basically cut right across the middle of Palestine, separating the city-states in the north from the city-states in the south. The city-states in the south make an alliance together, and they come up to attack the Gibeonites because they see that they've made a treaty with the Israelites. And because the Gibeonites have just made this treaty, even though it was something God did not want, but because Joshua and the elders had sworn by the name of the Lord that they were going to be in a covenant relationship with these people, when they're attacked, they cry out to Joshua for help. And so Joshua takes his army and marches it from Gilgal over to Gibeon, delivers the city. This is the occasion where Joshua prays to God that he would hold the sun up in the sky to give them more time to slaughter their enemies. And for a whole day and a whole night, the sun remains in the sky. I think probably maybe for a literal 24-hour period. And Joshua and his army defeat those who attack the Gibeonites, but then they make a sweep down to the south into the southern campaign, defeating city after city after city until they get almost all the way to Kadesh Barnea, which was on the southern extreme of the Promised Land. And from there, they turn their attention to the north, where now Joshua's battle-hardened army gains victory after victory after victory, essentially taking all of the military power away from all of the city-states in the land of Canaan. What's interesting about this is we're not sure how long these campaigns lasted. Simply not told to us in the biblical account. But I would suggest to you it's not unreasonable to guess that they had to have occupied a period of at least 2 years. No more than 6.5 years. That's based on some internal evidence from the book of Joshua itself. But once the majority of these campaigns were over and most of the kings and their cities had been defeated, the land was then divided among the tribes of Israel, each one receiving an inheritance. And this is the part of the story that is lost on most of us. In fact, most of you might not have even realized that chapters 13 through 22 were in the book of Joshua because it's something that nobody ever reads or anybody ever talks about unless you have a penchant for ancient Palestinian geography. Because all it is a list of cities and places on a map that none of us know where they're at, but they outline the boundaries of all of the tribes of Israel. And I'm just going to put it up here on a map because I think visually that's the best way to represent it rather than trying to weed our way through the text. The first was the reminder of the three tribes on the east side of the Jordan who had already received their allotment of land from Moses during his lifetime. We saw that in the book of Numbers. And then, after the conquests are over, land is allotted to the tribe of Judah, the tribes of Ephraim, and the other half of Manasseh on the west side of the Jordan River. And then we're told about Benjamin, Simeon, Zebulun, Issachar, Naphtali, Asher, and finally Dan. All of those tribes, the boundaries of each of their territories is clearly outlined in the text of Joshua 13 through 22. That's typically how we think of the land at the end of the conquest. This is the land that Israel possessed. What we need to understand, and something that I don't think we often appreciate, is that even though that was the outline of the territory that was designated for each of the tribes, at this point in time, the area that's shaded in yellow here on the map, that's probably all of the land that they actually had possession of. Because there was still Philistines that lived over here on the Mediterranean coast. There was the Sidonians in the north, and there was all these other little pockets of resistance, one of the main ones being in Jebus, Jerusalem. The Jebusites, they weren't going to be kicked out of there until King David comes on the scene and defeats them almost 400 years after the conquest begins. And that's something that illustrates the fact that the Israelites didn't do the task that had been given to them. God said, go into the land, I will drive the inhabitants out before you, take possession of all of it, utterly destroying all the inhabitants of the land. And yet, that is not something that the Israelites succeeded in doing. Their lack of a full conquest, as we'll see, plays a major role in the next stage of their history. But at this point, the majority of the conquest is over, and the men from the tribes of Reuben, Gad, and East Manasseh are released to go home to their families. And when they arrive at the Jordan River, they're getting ready to cross over, and they decide, we should do something to commemorate the fact that we are brethren with those who live on the other side of the river. We don't want them to think that we don't have any care for them, or that we're not going to worship in Jerusalem, or, well, it wasn't Jerusalem, it's Shiloh at this point where the tabernacle is set up. Let's build a memorial here on the banks of the river to be a visible reminder that we are brethren. And so they make a replica of the altar that was at the tabernacle. When the rest of the Israelites hear about this, they think that their eastern brethren have gone off into idolatry. And civil war almost ensues, except for the fact that Joshua says, maybe we ought to inquire here a little bit before we just attack our countrymen. And so Phinehas, son of Aaron, goes and talks to them and finds out that this is not sacrilegious, this is not an idolatrous idol, it's not even intended to be used to make sacrifices, it's just to be a visible reminder that we are still a part of the nation of Israel. And so crisis is averted. And in the final days of Joshua, as he has now become an old man, he, like Moses before him, gathered all the people together and addresses them before his death, encouraging them to remain faithful to the Lord and to finish the work of taking the land, removing all the inhabitants and their wicked, idolatrous influences, that they would not be lured away into idolatry and away from their total devotion to God. And it's obviously in this great speech that Joshua makes his famous statement, now therefore fear the Lord and serve him in sincerity and truth. If it's disagreeable in your sight to serve the Lord, choose for yourselves today whom you will serve, whether the gods which your fathers served, which were beyond the river, or the gods of the Amorites in whose land you are living. But as for me and my house, we will serve the Lord. And that's really what Joshua wanted the Israelites to continue to do even after he died. But as we'll see, that's not exactly what happened. And Joshua dies at the age of 110. Again, we don't know for sure when this was. We're not told how old Joshua was, for example, when they went in to spy out the land or when the conquest began. Things that would help us to pinpoint a date of his death. But a realistic guess, I would suggest to you, is in the ballpark of 15 to 20 years after the crossing of the Jordan and initially coming in to the land. But because of this uncertainty, it's difficult to say exactly when the events in Joshua end and the events in the book of Judges begin. There's some overlap in the two accounts, as we see. But that brings us then to the period of the Judges, which lasts for about 340 years. And I want to make a couple of preliminary observations about the book of Judges before we get into some of the details. We need to understand that the book of Judges doesn't tell us everything about every judge. In fact, it may not even tell us about every judge. There are five chapters in the book of Judges that don't even mention a judge, period, chapters 17 through 21. And information about six of the 12 judges that we are told about occupies only 14 verses of information in the book. In fact, there's only one detailed account of the life of a judge in the book of Judges, that is from his birth to his death, and that's the account of Samson. in chapters 13 through 16. But what the book of Judges does do is it paints a picture of the rebellion that's going on in the land of Israel during these early days. The first two chapters talks about how each tribe progressively did worse and worse at taking possession of their respective inheritance. It goes from the tribe of Judah going in and not fully annihilating all the Canaanites, and so some of the Canaanites have to dwell with them, to now the last tribe. It's not that the Canaanites are dwelling with the Israelites. The Israelites are now dwelling among the Canaanites. And because they were not successful in getting the inhabitants of the land out as God had commanded, those inhabitants become a thorn in their side and a plague to them. In fact, the times of the judges can best be characterized by a statement that occurs twice in the book, in chapter 17 and verse 6, and chapter 21 and verse 25, where it says, "In those days there was no king in Israel. Everyone did what was right in his own eyes." And we see a cyclical nature in the book of Judges that begins with the people being at peace, but then they turn away from God to idolatry. God raises up an oppressor to come in and punish them. After a period of punishment, the people cry out in their misery and despair to God. God hears them, and he sends a deliverer, a judge, who helps them defeat their oppressors, and then they again experience a time of peace. And over and over and over again, the cycle will be repeated. That's the picture that is painted in the book of Judges. But we need to understand this about the book of Judges. It does not paint this picture by following a strict chronological order. In fact, there are some internal indications that the events in chapter 17 through 22 occurred during the very early days of the judges. Chapter 17 and 18 involves the idolatry in the house of Micah and the Danites rejecting their allotted portion in the south and wanting to move up towards the north. Chapters 19 through 21 involves the degradation of a Levite's concubine by the men of the city of Gibeah, something that sounds very similar to the story of Sodom when the angels went and visited the house of Lot. And because of that, Gibeah, which was in the tribe of Benjamin, a subsequent civil war actually ensues, leading to the near annihilation of the entire tribe of Benjamin, except for about 600 men. So those things that come at the end of the book of Judges actually happen at the beginning of that time period. And then another thing that we need to note is that when we look at the judges themselves, there has to be, and I say it that way, there has to be some significant overlap between the judges. That is, it's not always that one judge ends and then the next begins, but one might begin while another is still judging. We say this because if you add up all the years that are given for times of oppression or times of peace or times that the guys are judging, you come up with too many years to fit into a known time period. We only have 305 to 340 years in which to fit the book of Judges. If you add up all those years that are given in the book, you get 410 years. And you can see how the math just isn't going to work out there. And so there has to be some overlap of the judges. And one thing that we need to understand, and hopefully I'll represent it visually on the map here, is that not all of the judges worked in the same area, nor, and if, again, looking at the chart, you'll see that not all of them fought against the same oppressors. And so it's quite feasible that many of the judges worked contemporaneously with one another. Othniel does his work down in Judah. It would appear that after him, Ehud does his work in the plains around Jericho and in the Transjordan area in Gad and Reuben. Shamgar, though, at the same time, is fighting against the Philistines on the other side of the nation. Deborah and Barak, they are dealing with things that are going on in the northern tribes up there in North Palestine. Gideon, for his part, is working in the plains of Jezreel, which is south of Mount Carmel, probably in West Manasseh. At the same time, Tola and Jair are working in Ephraim and in Gilead on the other side of the Jordan. And then maybe one of the areas that I didn't really appreciate how much overlap there was when you get to the days of Jephthah, you've got Jephthah working over in Gilead on the other side of the Jordan. You've got Ibzan working in Bethlehem, Elon up in Zebulun, and Abdon in Ephraim. All of them seem to be working in different places at the same time. But here's another overlap. Those guys also overlap with Samson, who did most of his judging and work down in the area around Gaza and on the Philistine coast. But you might not have realized this. Samuel, even though he's not listed in the book of Judges, he was certainly a judge, and he lived contemporaneously with Samson. In fact, they probably worked, maybe not exactly hand in hand, but they worked in coordination with one another, even if they did not realize it. There's evidence that Samson's killing of the Philistine lords and ladies in his death, there in the house of Dagon, the god of the Philistines, where he pushes the pillars out and collapses the whole house down, and it says that in his death he killed more Philistines than he had killed in his entire life. It's probably only a month or so after that that Samuel will win the decisive battle with the armies of Israel against the Philistines up in Mizpah around 1055 BC. Could it be that they had the upper hand against the Philistines in Mizpah because they had suffered such a great loss at the destruction and death that Samson had brought about at his death? That seems to be what the evidence indicates. What's interesting to me is that during this time period, within the book of Judges, we also have the account of Ruth. This is where it fits in, probably during the days of Gideon. And Ruth, of course, is the story of a young Moabitess who had married into the Israelite family, but was soon widowed and then migrated back to Bethlehem with her mother-in-law, Naomi, where she was redeemed by a close family relative named Boaz, with whom she had a son who would become the grandfather of King David, who ultimately will become the forefather of, as I mentioned before, the King, King Jesus. It really is a wonderful and heartwarming story, containing all of the elements of a great novel: joy and sadness, despair, suspense, love, redemption, and even the happily ever after. It serves as a good contrast, showing the other side of the coin in Israel during this time period of the Judges. If you read the book of Judges, you think that nobody's doing the right thing whatsoever. But the story of Ruth shows us that even in the midst of that chaos and rebellion, where everybody does what's right in their own eyes, that there were still some people who loved God and served God faithfully and lived in relative peace and harmony with those around them. And then finally, as is already mentioned, we have the beginning of the story of Samuel here. Samuel was born to Hannah and Elkanah, who was a descendant of Levi through Kohath, at the request of Hannah to God. Remember, she prayed to God to give her a son and promised that if God would do so, she would dedicate that child to his service. And Samuel is born, and he is taken then and dedicated to God at a very young age. Though we're not told how old Samuel was at his death or exactly when he was born, we can guess based again on some internal evidence from Scripture. But I would suggest to you that he had to have been born sometime prior to 1100 BC, which makes him not only a contemporary of Samson, but probably a little bit older than Samson. And he certainly lived longer than Samson and continued his work after Samson's death. He was raised in and around the tabernacle by Eli the priest, where he gained an appreciation for God's law and was called at a young age by God directly to be his prophet. And it would have been in this environment that Samuel would have seen the wickedness of Israel, exemplified by Eli's sons who took advantage of people and took bribes. He would have witnessed the capture of the Ark of the Covenant of God by the Philistines. He would have seen the time when Eli's sons were killed in that battle, and the news was brought back to Eli, and when Eli heard that the ark had been captured, he fell out of his chair backwards and broke his neck. And after the death of Eli and his sons, which was, by the way, judgment God had foretold to Samuel, Samuel rises naturally to a position of primary leadership among the nation of Israel. By calling, he was a prophet. By work, he was a judge. And by his heritage, he was qualified to be a priest. And we see him in his lifetime fill all three of those functions. As their leader, he appeals to the Israelites to return to God and rallies them in a resounding victory over the Philistine oppressors at Mizpah, raising up the rock that he calls Ebenezer, Rock of Help. And at this point, all seems to be making a very positive turn in Israel. Samuel is their judge, prophet, and priest, leading them, the people now turning back to God, enjoying a time of rest from oppression, but all would not remain so. This time, instead of rejecting God for an idol, the people of Israel reject God as their king and request to have a mortal man to rule over them so that they might be like all the other nations around them. And so we see in the nation of Israel that even when they have some good leadership, the people have a tendency to turn away from God and reject him, if not for an idol, then for another king. And always they want to be like the other nations. And so looking ahead, we're going to see how this rejection of God as king and demanding a king like the nations negatively impacts the kingdom of Israel. And how God, by choosing people whose hearts are devoted to him, will continue to make provisions for his plan of redeeming a lost humanity, even when it seems like his people are not cooperating.